First, at a few different points in their school years, Wisconsin students are taught about the state's federally recognized Native American tribes, their histories, and their cultures. But that wasn't always the case, and there was no policy or law to make sure it would happen until Act 31 was passed in 1989. J.P. Leary is a member of the Cherokee and Delaware Nations. He's an associate professor of humanities, First Nation studies, and history at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He served as the American Indian Studies Consultant at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction from 1996 until 2011. His new book is titled The Story of Act 31, How Native History Came to Wisconsin Classrooms. He joins us from our WPR studios in Green Bay. JP, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Rob. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I want to set the scene in the early to mid-80s here in Wisconsin, when a group of Ojibwe moved to reassert their treaty rights in the state. Give us the background on that story and what followed.
Sure. Very quickly, two brothers from Le Coup d'Oreille, Fred and Mike Tribble, in 1974 created a test case reasserting treaty rights that were first reserved in treaties signed in 1837 and 1842 with the federal government of the United States. And that litigation wound its way through the court system, and in 1983, the federal courts found that, yes, indeed, those treaty rights did still exist, and they were still valid. And so from 1983 to about 1991, there was ongoing litigation to determine what the scope of those rights was to be, who could regulate for things like safety and environmental protection, and whether any damages were due for the roughly century or so that those rights had been infringed.
And you mentioned reasserting rights. As I understand it, as you write about these treaties, when they were signed back in the 1830s, they were along the lines of the Native American representatives saying, yes, you can use this land, but we maintain certain, I think the legal term is usufruct rights, right to use it for, use the natural resources in ways that we've been doing all along. Do I have that right?
You have it exactly right, Rob, that when you own a piece of land, you also own things like mineral rights and usage rights and all of this. And so with these large-scale real estate transactions, essentially, what you have is the Ojibwe peoples reserving the right to use that land. So that remained essentially unceded or unsold.
Now, take us into the backlash. People look back and I think talk about the spearfishing controversy, but take us back to how these rights started to be exercised and the reaction they were met with.
Sure. So the book is called The Story of Act 31, and the sort of oversimplified, I think, story says that we had the Voight decision in 1983, which re-recognized these treaty rights, and then we end up with some legislative and actions that create new statutory requirements for teaching about history, culture, and tribal sovereignty. What I'm saying, though, is if you look at that post-Voight decision backlash, which escalated into violent controversies, and there was the real fear that someone would be killed at a Wisconsin boat landing by protesters up throughout the 1980s. And so what I decided to ask is, where did those protests come from? And so that lens sort of reframes this from another example of social policy, where we're taking a social issue and looking to the schools to solve it, to really asking questions like, well, where did the backlash come from? And why was there so little public understanding of key issues like tribal history, tribal cultures, tribal sovereignty, and treaty rights, of course? And so what I got to looking at was, what opportunities did past generations of Wisconsin students have to learn about these issues? So rather than vilify any individual person, rather than look at things like racism, stereotyping, and discrimination as individual failings, I took a broader, more systemic kind of approach to really look at that, and then to think about how did tribal leaders, Native educators, and allies transform curriculum policy in the state of Wisconsin to address those issues.
And that is the heart of your book. Let's talk about what was out there and what wasn't out there in education before Act 31, which we'll get into in a minute. What were people in Wisconsin learning and not learning about Native Americans past and present?
Right. So one of the issues is that when you look at how Native people are depicted in curriculum materials, there's sort of an ongoing issue with sort of two dynamics. One is invisibility, so it's absence, and the other is problematic presence, meaning that Native people are often included in biased and stereotypical ways when they are included. And so one of the things that I was looking at was looking at the way that social studies, and let me be clear, social studies, because that's what the law requires, is that this instruction is in social studies. So it's not only social studies. The best way to think about it is at least social studies. And so I looked at the history of social studies education and looked at the ways that social studies curriculum policy was responding to social crises. So, for example, what was going on in social studies in response to World War II? What was going on in social studies in response to the Civil Rights Movement? What was going on in social studies with these other big sort of social issues? And there really wasn't, there was a parallel insofar as the field was very slow to respond to these sorts of things. So what I then did was moved into looking at how does this play out in Wisconsin. And so I looked at one of the leading textbooks that first came out in the 1950s called Exploring Wisconsin. And I looked at multiple editions, and I got to see through that how the story was told and how it was shaped by the events of the era. But those textbooks, they only really tell what we think we taught, right? It validates certain kinds of knowledge. And by the way, for most of those editions, there was much more included about Paul Bunyan, so a fictional white man, than anything about Native people. That's just an interesting aside. So then I looked at a journal called Badger History, put out by my publisher, the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Badger History came up by the Historical Society from 1948 to about 1980. And one of the interesting things about Badger History is it shows not just what we think we taught, but it includes actual student work product. So we know what students actually learned. And part of the reason that's interesting is we see that feedback loop. So we see the student produce some piece of work in response to ostensibly a teacher-created assignment. That teacher then evaluates that favorably, then sends that down to Madison, where it's again reviewed by the editors of Badger History. And then it's then put out statewide as exemplary student work about Wisconsin history. Some of that is includes some significant misunderstandings. So they talk about being among the wonderful Menominee dancers of the Lac du Flambeau Reservation. And of course, Lac du Flambeau is an Ojibwe reservation. So looking at how that level of misunderstanding went all the way up the line. And then we also see an issue came out in 1948 in which the same issue, the very next article, talks about the Declaration of Human Rights, and it talks about genocide. Well, there's a short story told from the perspective of the Fox River about the, and it's, the history is wrong too, but celebrating the genocide of the Fox Nation. And how the river was running red with blood, and the gay and gallant Frenchmen would have unfettered access to river passage.
I want to get to Act 31 itself, JP. So with that background you just laid out, in the midst of this the treaty controversies of the 80s, what were people trying to accomplish? How are they trying to change what was taught in schools?
Right. The way that I think about it, and I want to be clear that I worked at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction from 1996 to 2011 as the American Indian Studies consultant. So in that capacity, I had the opportunity to work with and learn from a lot of the people that were absolutely instrumental in creating this, what was at that time the most specific curriculum requirement in terms of content to be taught, enacted in the state of Wisconsin. And as you know, we've long prided ourselves on a history of local control. And so as we say, then, schools must teach about history, culture, and tribal sovereignty, that was unprecedented. But I'm talking about people like Alan Caldwell. And the late Alan Caldwell worked, he was the first American Indian Studies consultant at the Department of Public Instruction. He also served in, there was a number of key organizations that worked together. Department of Public Instruction, Wisconsin Indian Education Association, Great Lakes Intertribal Council, American Indian Language and Culture Education Board, and then the state legislature's American Indian Study Committee, which included a number of public members. And so we see people like Alan Caldwell, member of the Menominee Nation, at DPI, also on WIEA board, also a technical advisor to the American Indian Study Committee. We see, at that time, UW-Green Bay's own Bill Galnick, a member of the Oneida Nation, worked with the American Indian Language and Culture Education Board, later joined the American Indian Studies program at the Department of Public Instruction. Dorothy W. Davids, the late Dorothy Davids, member of the Mohican Nation. And one of the things that I tell in the very early in the book is the story of Dorothy's dad. And Dorothy's dad spoke at the American Indian Chicago Conference, calling for the kind of policies that would later echo in what was enacted in Act 31. And then also looking at some of the key legislative figures, Representative Sharon Metz, former Rep. Sharon Metz, is kind of one of the unsung heroes of this. Many people know her work through Honor Our Neighbors, Origins and Rights, and doing that treaty rights support kind of work. But she was absolutely instrumental as a Wisconsin legislator. Representative Frank Boyle. And none of this would have happened without support from Governor Tommy Thompson. So there were some interesting political alliances that led to this to happen. And it was some coordinated efforts across Indian country, across Indian Ed, and within state government as well.
Can you run through what changed in Wisconsin curriculum for a student in a classroom? What would they encounter that was different thanks to those efforts you just laid out?
Mm-hmm. So what we see, the law required students to receive instruction at least twice in K-8 and at least once in high school. It required that their teachers have received instruction in history, culture, and tribal sovereignty, either as part of their pre-service ed or part of their ongoing professional development associated with licensure. It required use of much more multicultural curriculum materials. It was part of a broader human relations instruction. So it really took a high context, multifaceted approach to reshaping and recrafting opportunities to learn for students in Wisconsin.
And are we living up to what was laid out there now in 2018?
There are some real bright spots around the state, and much of this you can see on a website called WisconsinFirstNations.org. So you can see some of the exemplars. You can see interviews with some of the outstanding teachers around the state and some of the video clips that can be used in the classroom.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. JP, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Rob.
JP Leary is an associate professor of humanities, First Nation studies, and history at UW-Green Bay. He joined us from our WPR studios in Green Bay to talk about his new book. It's called The Story of Act 31, How Native History Came to Wisconsin Classrooms.